when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society can sometimes make us feel ashamed of. My name is Caroline and I'm an undead murderous five-year-old, played by Kirsten Dunst. Joining me is the Brat Prince rockstar of all vampires, Siobhan McSweeney.
Hey, I'm Lestat.
The vampire Lestat. We're talking about Anne Rice today.
Yeah, Anne Rice.
The sort of the godmother of all supernatural, really.
I think of baroque gothic, really, of sort of luxurious, sexy gothic.
This is very interesting to me because I'm very much a luxurious, sexy gothic person as well. And we're from the same place. We're both from Cork City, bitch.
Yeah.
I think Cork is intrinsically goth.
Well, I was thinking, I was sort of panicking coming on this, going, what can I possibly talk about? But then I was like, what can I talk about that can sort of contribute in any sort of way to the conversation about her? Because, you know, her books are so intrinsically, they're either set in, you know, she has this American ideal.
Yes.
And ideal of America and of Europe. And none of those things sort of match up in my head with certainly how I was reared. She wasn't, she never mentioned a bungalow bliss, 1970s generic bungalow out in Arhula in the 80s and 90s, you know, like that wasn't
wasn't her concern.
That wasn't a concern her for her. It was more a sort of luxurious
New Orleans hotels, dimly lit.
Yeah, and like sort of old Parisian stuff and like plantations, like everything, heavy humid air, which I suppose Cork does have, but there the similarity ends. But yes, I think there is something inherently gothic in Cork, yeah. I mean, when I was a teenager, like I say I was a goth, but it wasn't. It was around the time of grunge, you know? So it was more, but like I used to sneak out and go to like the Forum, which wasn't a goth pub per se. It wasn't sort of, but it was, you know, it was the Cure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think my theories, I thought about this for a long time because I write supernatural books and because whenever I write them, I can't seem to stop writing about Cork at the same time.
Yeah.
This thing of like, I think because there's nothing between us and America. We're just the Atlantic. And it casts this kind of blue light over everything, this kind of slightly gloomy light that makes shadows look longer sooner.
Yeah.
And you got all this metal happening in Cork. Yeah. There's like two metal clubs.
Yeah.
There's like this whole, there's a big, like, lot of goth shops.
Yes.
And there's
yes.
something that's infused the territory. So when you picked Anne Rice today, who is just like the grandmother of all gothic, although, you know, grandmother, she's not old. She's the mother of all gothic.
Uh-huh.
It instantly clicked for me. I was like, oh, of course Siobhan would be obsessed with this. Like, when did you find her?
I was a teenager. I'm just thinking like St. Finbar's, our cathedral
yes.
in Cork as well. Like
yes.
that's done in this very sort of typical gothic architecture. But I also think as well, like as much as, I don't know if you had that when you moved over here, I certainly had it when I moved to drama school, the expectation of what an Irish person should be and sort of battling against that because
yes.
I didn't, well, just because I'm contrary and also I didn't recognise it necessarily. Nobody wants to be reduced to something or in fact elevated to something. But I think as I've gotten older and more confident and not even more confident, I don't give a shit anymore, frankly, this idea of the cliche of what the Yanks and the Brits are like, this idea of the supernatural in Ireland, the way that we're constantly accompanied by fucking Enya on a white horse and a Ballygowan ad stomping over the Burren. Like, it's something that we roll our eyes at, but it's something we inherently understand as well. Whether it is part of us, whether it's real or whether it's been thrust upon us, we carry that with us, right? So like when you're reading books that just start from the premise that there are vampires and they're very sexy, that, you know, there's no sort of, I cannot believe there are, really? Well, you must spend at least, you know, a whole arc of a book trying to convince me there. Like, that's where we start. That's where we go straight in. I'm like, yeah, you got me. I'm there. Tell me more about the cheekbones. But
the alabaster skin and the glinting
stop it. Yeah, no, divine. So when I was a teenager, and also I think it's romance, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Like, you have the gory stuff, you have the really sort of like, oh, they're what are they eating? They're in muck. And but the one thing about Anne Rice, she had an idealized idea. Thank you. Yes, other people write my words. This idea of like places and like, you know, she'd have a lot of shorthand, like if you were Irish, you know, if you were French or blah, blah, blah. But she did sort of give me like a sort of history of the Visigoths and and Egyptian culture
and New Orleans.
Yeah. And like there's sort of a lot of history in there as well, you know, and a lot of philosophy, this idea of eternal life. And when I was a teenager, and still, but especially when I was a teenager, this idea of living forever, you know, it's...
And being young and beautiful the entire time.
Being young and beautiful the entire time and exploring what the possibility of eternity is. And when you're first beginning to sort of slowly edge yourself out of the nest and wonder whether to take the great jump or something, there's something about the sort of self-absorption of being a teenager, the self-absorption that has to be there when you're a teenager, that goes, maybe I'll be the one who'll live forever. And would that be awful? And yeah, I loved the sort of pseudo-philosophical stuff with it as well. It made me feel very smart while I was being horny.
And if you can get that, if you can, as a writer, if you can nail that Venn diagram, you'll never go hungry again.
I know.
The thing about vampires and teenage girls in general, and teenagers in general.
Yeah.
Because like, obviously, you know, Anne Rice was, her book were most famous in the 80s and early 90s. Then obviously we had Stephanie Meyer come along with the Twilight stuff. And like, they've never stopped being this real horny fixation for young girls. And I think, I'm going to speak carefully because I'm sort of edging into like both fantasy and reality here, and I don't want one to be confused with the other. You're sort of obsessed with sexuality and sex when you're that age, and you're also afraid of it.
Yeah.
And you're sort of have this sense that you may be ruined should you have it, and also that you should ever want it too much. And so I do think when you're a young girl and you're also not allowed out at night because you're told of all the things that are going to happen to you if you go out there, and this is lots of admin around who's going to drive you home from where in case you might be alone on a dark street for any moment of time and someone will seize upon you. Mm-hmm. And I think because of that, young girls get this real fantasy in their heads of like a handsome stranger seizing upon me alone in the night and is like obsessed with the youth of my flesh and the thing of like me being young and there and mortal and full of blood kind of thing. Yeah. And I do think that whole vampire victim fantasy thing, I think it's very real for young girls. I think the idea of just being taken and having something happen to you and you have no choice.
That's exactly the idea of surrender.
Yes.
The idea of surrender, which I think is a huge thing. I think also at the time, as I said, you know, like it was grunge and rock, and this idea of vulnerability was a weird one to navigate around when you're a teenager or in your early 20s or something. And these books maybe take that dilemma away from you, where it can sort of go, it's vampires, so it does, you know, that difference between fantasy and reality.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to represent your strident burgeoning views at the time in real life and in your politics.
Yeah.
But you can sort of surrender to succumbing to something, you know? And I think maybe that's the appeal of it. I think certainly my idea of womanhood was so anti, it was very basic. It was anti-softness.
Really?
Yeah.
Why did you do that?
I think it was just the time. I think it was, you know, like it was the 90s. It was sort of, you were one of the lads. Mm. You know, if you wore dresses, you wore them ironically. Mm. You wore boots. You were King Gordon, you know. You were Kim Deal. You were anybody yeah. called Kim. but like as in this idea of softness was just easily equated to weakness.
Yeah.
And it felt like a time because you are coming into your own and you feel strong. And to associate yourself with weakness. And you're so at that cusp where you can see where your life could go. You could continue along one line and, you know, be fucking married to the engineer in Sunday's Well or something.
Sunday's Well is quite an elite suburb of Cork City. Just
but you know, do you know what I mean? Like, or of like some cunt with a yacht. Like,
yeah.
I mean, and these were not the circles I was hanging out in, by the way. But you know, that sort of wifey thing. Mm-hmm. And it just seems very black and white when you're a teenager.
Yes.
And the way boys would treat you would be very black and white as well. Even if they weren't, that's how you would receive it. That's how I received it. And so the idea of not I think now in my old age, I can sort of go the idea of not being vulnerable around my specific idea of femininity was a real driving force. Feeling like wanting to feel powerful and sort of maybe co-opt a masculine paradigm for that.
Yes. And the sort of fantasy of like, because there's fantasy of being sort of the victim of a vampire, right?
Yeah.
But there's the fantasy of being turned.
Yeah.
Just like working life and office life and corporate life, that it kills most people, but it chooses some to elevate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, very good.
and that thing of like the vampires, they slaughter most mortals, but special ones, sexy ones, ones like you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They could take to the sort of the mortal plane because they're so lonely in their immortality that you must join them for an eternity.
Yes. I think also as
and
well.
And you'll be rich.
And you'd be rich. But also you'd be let in on a secret. You know, this idea of secret as well. This idea of something larger than yourself. And I think when I was all my life, the idea of something being larger than myself, especially, you know, when you lose your faith that you've been brought up with.
Yeah.
But still believing that there has to be more than the office. I mean that in every sense, by the way. the idea that there could be more. Like, I used to wish upon a star when I was young that I would be an actor. Do you know? For Starlight, Starbright, First Star, See Tonight. That was the thing I wished for. And I remember just making, if I could make a deal with God. And like just sort of cajoling and bargaining and doing whatever I could because I knew there had to be something more than the life that was being laid out for me.
And this is what Anne Rice was so good at entertaining and pulling on as well. Mm. Like even, so you have Interview the Vampire is her first book. She writes it, I think, in 1976. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating about that is that it's a short book, but it's quite a slow read. It's like, it's clearly someone who's not come in totally to their craft yet. But she wrote it after the death of her daughter, and it's quite a moving book to read in light of that, because you can say there's a child character in it who her sort of punishment is that she never dies. Mm. But it's also this thing of her character is so brooding. It's the stencil of the brooding vampire, right? But you can that angst is coming from a real place, which is a mother. I think, anyway, my interpretation is a mother saying, "What am I supposed to do all alone forever now that you're gone?" You know, and it's a really, when you read it in that context, it's quite upsetting, actually.
Yeah.
Then she moves on with the series, and she sort of, like, you can tell she was working through something to get through that. And I think that's what makes many people writers, because they have some great thing that they need to work through. Before we start recording, we were speaking about Maeve Binchy and how she looked after her father for a long time and then she started writing. And it's not because her father was trapping her, it's because she needed to write to recover from that, you know?
Yeah.
And I really believe that first book is about working through some kind of trauma. And then she starts to have more fun with it. And then she has this character, Lestat, who becomes her cash cow of her entire career, who's like this mischievous vampire who goes on to be a rock star. And this whole thing of like, sorry, I can't remember the original point I was trying to make.
but the idea of working through something that she has fun with it. But again, that sort of goes back to sort of my idea that there's more. There is more, and that
this
the great and noble art being torn, like it's art, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that, yes, we can just live or we can create.
Exactly. And this thing of like, she does it so cleverly in the book. So she publishes Interview with a Vampire. It's short. It's sort of okay received. And then a few years, she does some other stuff. She comes back to the vampires a few years later. And then she starts teasing her audience, saying like, Interview the Vampire, cleverly disguised as fiction and all this kind of stuff. And it talks about how these books themselves in their publication are affecting the vampire world. And this thing of like, some younger vampires think it's kind of cool. Some vampires are very pissed off that you're sharing their sacred history, you know. And I felt like 12 reading Queen of the Damned the other day. I was like, it was like, you know, Lestat in the first person saying, oh, Louis, talking about this, talking all kinds of shite. Everyone thinks it's fiction and ha 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 kind of thing. And everyone loves my book too. But part of me was like 12 being like, what if it is real?
See? See?
What if he's telling the truth? And what if Anne Rice is a pseudonym and an actress?
Yeah, right? I know. And it's again, you know, it plays into that idea of what if?
Yeah. I wonder if this could be a real long shot, a real deep cut reference, but have you ever heard of a book called Lady Cottington's Pressed Fairy Book?
No.
No. It was this very strange book that was, it was written by Terry Jones, weirdly, of Monty Python, but it was purported to be the diary of a young girl who was trapping fairies in her books. And it was like this, like very, it was like a children's book, but all kind of strangely pornographic images of fairies being squashed to death.
Ah, Terry.
Oh, Terry. He of the foot, the Monty Python foot. But it took me a really long time to come around to the idea that this was a fiction. Because it had a foreword being like, this book was discovered. And it was the same with the Flowers in the Attics book.
This was
discovered in the attics. I just, every time I have any kind of foreword from any author being like, I found this book in an attic somewhere,
I believe it.
And I blame the Diary of Anne Frank.
Yes.
I read that book too young. And then I thought all diaries that were definitely real.
I remember my coming home and I was 9. Like, that was too old. That was too old, Siobhan. Came home and I was like, Mam, Martin Miller said that he found Santy's presents in his mother's wardrobe.
Yeah.
And Mam went, what? I went, Martin Miller says, like, what does that mean? That there's no Santy? And she went, oh, well, he's wrong. He's wrong. I went, yeah, I thought so. And I went down to my room. And she came down and she followed me. And I distinctly remember, because I was kneeling on the floor beside the radiator, and it must have been around like this time of year, because I was leaning against the radiator because it felt lovely and cold. And I was just like, whatever I was doing, pulling the wings off flies or whatever. No, like whatever I was doing. And she came down, she knelt beside me and she sort of said, Siobhan, you do know he was telling the truth, don't you? And I went, yeah, I know. And she left, and I swear to God, I looked up to the sky and I went, I still believe.
Oh.
9.
9.
9, far too old.
I was 10.
Oh!
Yeah.
Oh.
I wanted to hold on to these things for so long, and I'm still that way. Like, I don't, like, as you know, I love like my tarot cards and stuff, but I'm not like super into like holistic mind, body, spirit, horoscopes, that all that kind of stuff. I'm into the vast mystery of like, are ghosts real?
Yeah. Like, there's a bit of me going,
I don't really want self-care. I don't really want a rock to make me feel better.
But I also don't want to know more.
Yeah.
I don't want to know more. I'm like, the keys are gone. Of course they're gone. Jeepers. Yeah. Well, you know where they're gone. I don't want to know. They're fine. And
that's very Irish of us, though. That thing of like always referring to the fairies as like my neighbours, my fond neighbours, the kind people who live outside my eye line.
Yeah.
That is still a thing.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just, it's hilarious how I have no interest in investigating that thought any further. Not for fear that it would scare me, but for fear it would disappear.
Yeah. I love that about us.
I love that for us.
I love that for us. And like, I wonder if it is something to do with Catholicism, because Anne Rice, big Catholic,
oh, yeah. big
and
Catholic.
She came but in came and back, out of it
yes.
a lot.
Yes.
Which I respect. I respect someone who has the strength to change their mind and to publicly change their mind a couple of times.
No, not only a couple of times, but I really, as much as I love the writing vampires, mm-hmm. I really love her questioning.
Yes.
Love her. I love the philosophical side of it. The sort of like, what if, how awful it would be, you know, like to actually by the end of the book to go, God, it would be awful to live forever.
Yeah.
It would be so lonely, you know, existentially lonely. Like, and I'd still like it, though, you know, or I wouldn't like she makes you. It's not. God, it's a rich world, and it's an intelligent world. Like it's
yes, yeah.
It's a world that that places sort of sensuality and fun and mystery on an equal footing with intellect and philosophy.
That's so well put. Yes,
and I think that's where the guilty pleasure would mm-hmm. come in too. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
This idea of like, oh, that's why I didn't like Twilight. And I was like, this is
nor
just.
Nor did she?
Yeah. Well, this is just a format that you could have with anything. Yeah. It's a generic story. You've just made one tribe. It's West Side Story. Like, it's yes. just the same.
Yeah. It is West Side Story.
Yeah, which is just Romeo. It's just one is fur, one is thingies. But with this, it's something. It's like, what if life didn't end? What if you could do anything, what would you do? What, like with the witches stuff that comes in later, you know, mm-hmm. this idea of community and of female community and of inheritance, of family, of passing through the ages. And I think something about Ireland as well, where, you know, we all know our fucking history, do you know? And we very few of us are brought in to the island.
It's true.
You know, like, and if we are, it's, you know, blow-ins from the 1700s. Like, it's we are of a place, so we can track back. We take that as a given. We sneer or very sort of eye-rolly when the Yanks come back and they've got their family trees and all that sort of stuff. Or like, I was in Canada up till a couple of days ago, and I had a lovely driver, and he was bringing me around the place, and he was like, "And this is the oldest firehouse." Yeah, blah blah blah.
1912.
It was fucking 1912, and I was like, "Oh my god!" There's stuff in my fridge that is older than that. Like, I mean, and you could see he was like really proud, and I was just going, "Yeah, grand." And he sort of went, "I keep forgetting how old Europe is," and I'm like, "No, you keep forgetting that there was loads of stuff here before you arrived."
Yeah.
You know. But we know we have that as a given, and I think Anne Rice, like Yank, really, really wanted all that as well. So she wrote this world of history, of community, of family trees, of witching families, of and you go back over all the lineage. You go through a whole lineage. You go through hundreds and hundreds of years, and there's something comforting about that when you live. I don't know, not when you live forever, but like the idea of, you know, it's very much in vogue at the moment. The idea of the ancestors, isn't it?
Yes. The 23andMe of it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So she was onto something. It wasn't a story. It was a philosophy, and it.
And she is a very existential writer, because
yes.
that's the thing that you get, particularly in those vampire books. It's this constant thing of like, but why?
Yeah.
Why? Interview the Vampire. Louis and his vampire daughter, who is called Claudia, they kind of journey to Europe and they travel all over Europe and they go through sort of Transylvania and all this, and they see these kind of like what they call revenant vampires, who are these vampires who were turned and then buried and then had to sort of come up through the earth and are therefore feral. And they're like, oh God, if this is our history, it's like they are absolutely the Yanks who come to Europe in order to find their history. And then they keep getting disappointed, and then eventually they find these incredibly decadent Parisian vampires who tried to kill them. And they're like, oh, really? Yeah. This?
Yeah, it's all for nothing. Life is
for
nothing.
Yeah, yeah. And he finally has a kind of a conversation with like an elder vampire, and he's like, you know, Lestat wouldn't tell me anything. Please, now you tell me. And him being like, there's nothing.
Yeah.
Like, it's just this. We're just doing it. I don't know. Yeah. What do you want? Like,
and it's almost like she's not happy enough with that answer either.
No.
So she keeps questioning. She keeps questioning all the way through. And like when she drops the vampires and moves on to witches, and then
yes,
she doesn't necessarily drop the witches, but she brings in something else to the witches. And then, you know, like this, and then she has this stuff where she sends Lestat to heaven. You know, she's really working it out. She's stretching not only the genre, but her own philosophy with these ideas. What do we do with our past? How do we bring it forward? How do we lead good lives? Is there such a thing as goodness, inherent goodness, or good deeds?
And this thing of sin as well,
yeah,
which goes back to Catholicism,
yeah,
right? And this, and I do think that is part of, I think, why you and I are people who are very happy to settle with the idea that magic and mystery exists, and no wish to scientifically interrogate it whatsoever, but it just wants to leave it there. I think it's very Catholic. It's very Catholic not to question things,
yeah,
and to believe things.
Uh-huh.
And she definitely gets back to this thing of like sin.
Mm-hmm.
And a sin, if it's like, if it is a sin to kill a person, and also a sin to take the Lord's name in vain or whatever, then like, how do we measure these things, and how is the evil of, say, a vampire who kills two people a night to stay alive,
mm-hmm,
equal to the evil of a mortal who cheats their neighbor? You know what I mean? And
yeah,
this constant thing of like, do we stagger evil out in these stages? Does that make any sense? Is it our position to do so? Is God real? Is he measuring? Does he care?
Yeah,
like,
does he
it's
care?
constantly that.
And the idea of pleasure wrapped up in that.
Oh, God, it's so erotic. It's
so erotic. Like, is sin pleasurable? Is pleasure a sin? You know, and she we discussed that earlier. She has a sort of an erotic alias where she writes these very... personally, not erotic.
The fans of those books will often say they're called the Sleeping Beauty series.
Yeah.
The first is called Sleeping Beauty Claimed, I think.
And then Awakens or something like that.
And then Punished. And so when you contacted me, when we talked about what you were going to choose for this, I was like, oh, I've never read Anne Rice. What should I read? And then once I got into researching, I realized, oh, I have read Anne Rice, just not under the name Anne Rice. A few years ago, me and my friend Harry, who actually edits this podcast, so hi Harry.
Hi Harry.
We went on, we were in a band together, we went on like a songwriting vacation in a holiday home in Scotland, and Beauty Reclaimed was there, and we started reading out loud to each other, pissed, obviously, being like, ha ha ha. And it's like, the world of this book, it's like so hard to...
Oh my God.
So basically, the Sleeping Beauty myth is real, or like this is the world, the fairy tale kingdom where the Sleeping Beauty myth is happening. She is awakened by being raped by a prince. She's 16, but also 100, obviously, because she's been asleep. And you think like, oh, this is going to be a feminist tale of how...
Yeah, an Angela Carter-esque,
yes,
kind of...
It totally, it really begins Angela Carter, yeah, of like, let's examine these perverse tales that we,
yeah,
tell our children and what they mean and what they symbolize. And you're like, cool, I'm kind of... This,
yeah,
is disturbing, but I can get on board with this.
Uh-huh.
And then she is taken back to the prince's kingdom and inducted into a sort of a slave, sex slave harem.
Yeah.
And she loves it.
She loves it, but then it gets really confusing. And as I was saying earlier, I was like, were there horses? It was
okay,
pony play.
It was pony play.
Yeah.
There's butt plugs with tails in them.
Yeah.
There's nipple clamps that are function as reins.
Yeah.
It
wow.
is. It, fans of this book will say that it's this is not erotica. This is not, you know, the sort of...
Oh, right. What are they saying it is?
It's pornography.
Oh, okay.
It's not erotica, because erotica sort of like has sexy situations.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the Milton Boone. The Milton Boone books are actually quite tame. It's,
yeah,
like, there's generally like two or three sex scenes in them, and they're not that explicit. But this is just, it's every single page.
Yeah.
And when she talks about this work, she says, that was my mission. She said, when I was growing up, you would have a book that would get passed around school that would have the good pages thumbed down.
Yes.
And there would be like a picture of a pirate on the cover ravishing a woman with tits coming out up to her neck. She was like, I don't want to do that. I wanted the good part on every page.
Brilliant.
And if you're going to write a 700 page.
I mean, because they're tomes as well.
They're huge.
Fucking hell.
They're like, and the thing is, I think they are regarded as like these huge classics of the BDSM world, right? Like, and I think people who are into that lifestyle super rate them.
Yeah.
And like sort of got a lot of people who are in that lifestyle into the lifestyle. So live and let live.
Oh, totally, totally, totally. Like, no, but I thought maybe.
But they're extreme. Like,
they are extreme. It's you know, you're giggling, thinking about like velvet cushions and eating chocolates and living forever, and next thing you know you're an extreme pony place. So it's like, right, okay, wow, maybe we should, yeah, I just dinner first maybe. I like it just goes, yeah. But then you see, what a complicated woman, like, and well, not complicated, just normal.
Yeah, but willing to talk about, like, so she, what,
and
she,
her Catholicism and her like quite sort of devout Catholicism, in that she absconded from the church, then rejoined the faith, and then absconded again and then rejoined, like this, you know, she's able to live with contradiction really, really well, and no shame around it as well, you know. Which
I have a quote from her about religion, which I think is fucking brilliant. And I could see it on somebody's t-shirt. Not mine, but someone's. In the name of Christ, I refuse to be anti-gay. I refuse to be anti-feminist. I refuse to be anti-artificial birth control. I refuse to be anti-democrat. I refuse to be anti-secular humanism. I refuse to be anti-science. I refuse to be anti-life. In the name of Christ, I quit Christianity and being Christian. Amen. It's fucking cool.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, for a woman who was born in like 1940, you know. Yeah. And here's something else I fucking love about this woman as well.
Her fringe. She had such a cool fringe.
Yeah.
I'm very jealous of fringes, you see.
You could have a fringe.
I couldn't.
The thing is, only you can answer that question for yourself. Yeah. And don't listen to other people who can tell you you have a fringe. If you know in your heart, it can't happen.
It can't happen.
It can't happen. No. But she had a lovely thick fringe.
Oh, lovely fringe.
A real like paintbrush. That's sort of right. Thickness, you know.
Bauhaus kind of vibe. Yeah.
Yeah. But she refused to be sort of embarrassed by anything. And also, she was my favorite kind of writer. It's the kind of writer who can write something for the goodness of their own soul and for the interrogation of their own curiosity, but who, when that book becomes something else to another group of people, is so interested and curious in that, and doesn't try to pretend she always meant it to be like a gay allegory, which many people take the vampires to be, because it is all male-male relationships. Mm-hmm. And she's just... she says that the vampire books, as she said, she died last year, sadly, but the vampire books, she never meant to be a gay allegory, but they were taken up by the gay press in a huge way, and they were sort of kept alive by the gay press. And that curiosity in that whole world made her an enormous ally throughout her entire life, like hugely. And I imagine being from New Orleans is a big part of that. Like,
and her son as well, Christopher.
Is he gay?
He is gay, and they wrote together, and they had a very loving relationship.
And it was when she died, I think 6 or 7 months ago, in the same week there was like a lot of anti-trans stuff happening, just a lot of really ghastly stuff happening, and lots of very prominent fantasy writers who were being in favor of that stuff, which is gross. And at the same time, all this Anne Rice stuff was coming out. And all this stuff, like, okay, as far as like the sort of 70s, 80s, this is a woman who was born in 1940 who has been so pro-trans the entire time. And not just like, I'm willing to tolerate the existence of many genders.
Yeah.
But I think these, and again, I think trans people have done so much work on themselves and so much internalized sort of like examination of what, of the self, that they have an enormous amount to teach us. Mm-hmm. And this is something she says again and again and again. She, like, there's lots of like trans writers who talked about having direct relationships with her. And I just think I found it so moving, especially because we have created this narrative that I think is totally untrue, that trans civil rights exist for now, and that if you were born yesterday or maybe 3 days before yesterday, you can just about understand and grasp it. But how could we possibly expect older women or older people to grasp it? And then there's this woman who died in her 80s, who got it the whole time, got it instantly.
But also placed it in placed it within a context, a historical context. The trans community didn't arrive overnight.
Yeah.
You know, the awful stuff that is said, blue hair dye didn't arrive and the trans community. Like, they've always been with us. They are as much part of our human history as any other thing. And she was able to understand that and place that within a context where you feel yourself being placed as well, you know. And again, it's you know, so much of life, I think, is what do we do about loneliness? And so many, like, I really think the thing that I carry from all good art, but and I place her stuff there as well, is the idea of you're not alone. You're not alone in that. You're not alone because there's a ghost behind you. You're not alone because I too think that sometimes. You're not alone as in your mother and grandmother and great grandmother and great great grandmother and great great. You know, you come from, by virtue of being human, you already are not alone. And the idea of finding your own people and a tribe and everything. And she celebrates community by talking about one community at a time. But she celebrates the idea of community, which is celebrate. And, you know, that early discussion about what is there? There's just this. And maybe at the end of it, it's like, well, what is there? There's just us. And all we have is each other. And I think that's so beautiful, so beautiful. And at the end of any sort of exploration I have with any piece of art, be it a painting or something, or a piece of music or a play or a character or anything, it's the idea of there's just us, you know. There's a communication that has just happened. There is a, you're not alone. You're not alone for that little moment while you're connecting to something.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
That's really beautifully put. I'm very, very moved by that.
Aww.
Let's talk a bit more about the Mayfair Witches, which I haven't gotten around to reading yet, but I'm very curious about. Are they like your favourite of the Anne Rice's?
I think so, yeah. And perhaps because of those... Well, actually, it depends. I mean, like... Depends on what you want at the time. But what I love about the Mayfair Witches and that storyline is, again, that idea of family.
Female family.
Big female family. Also that idea of inheritance. I think there's a lot of it about at the moment, the idea of what we inherit, both as individuals and as countries and as societies. What is our inheritance?
It's so true, actually. I hadn't thought about that, but you are right.
Yeah, like the sort of, you know, the one of the I'm late to everything. So, you know, like what's that one about trauma at the moment?
Everything.
Yeah, I know. but it's in the body knows, keeps the score.
Yes.
And the sort of idea of epigenetics and the idea of and being Irish and being. I think it's becoming clearer that we, you know, I made a joke about how we know our history too much. But also there's stuff we don't know and we won't look at. And in Ireland, so much is beginning to get uncovered. You know, in a literal way, our own soil is vomiting up our past. And again, that's a connection. I think wholeness and integration,
yeah,
from an individual perspective and as a society, only happens when we fully look and accept our past and move on. And living in Brexit London and what's going on at the moment, there is no way of looking at the past here because it's not being taught. I go back to this time and time and time again, and I feel like I'm crowbarring, but I'm not. I'm thinking it out as I'm saying it. But the thing about the Mayfair witches is you see through a book, which books are brilliant for that. You see the generations and it passing down, not always through female line, but through male lines as well, male witches, blah, blah, blah. But you can sort of see, because she's writing a history. She's writing a history of this family, and you can, you know, you can always have the, oh, she's like the great-grandmother who's like this.
Yeah.
And you also see the evolution of a race, the evolution of a clan.
It's such an interesting thing, because it has sort of made me think of, like, I do feel like if there is like a theme to the kind of discussions that are happening at large at the moment, I think a lot of them can come back to inheritance, whether it's the literal thing of like the housing crisis and like the thing of like people being like, oh well, we've essentially inherited a sort of a feudal system whereby you can only own a home if you have a vast amount of money given to you by someone.
Yeah,
it's also this thing of like, I think so many young people in this country, in the UK, are just fighting with this idea of like what their responsibility is to the rest of the world, knowing that the amount of pleasure and privilege they enjoy is because of England's dominance, and enjoying it but also feeling bad about it.
Yeah.
And like no one knows what to do with any of that.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's this weird time. Maybe it's because we've all been indoors, but I feel like people are talking about their own generational trauma much more.
Much more. Yeah, I believe
like,
so.
The sense
and
that we're not just
credence.
These, yes. Yes.
Like sort of not moping, like, and also not ignoring, sort of finding a middle way of going, maybe some of my behavior is because of this, but that doesn't mean that I need to continue this way.
Yeah.
Maybe if I figure that out, I can move on. The tower. Do
the
you know?
The tower in tarot we're referring to.
And there seems to, like, it's evolution. It's evolutionary thought, isn't it? Like we're evolving. Our thought is evolving around these things, you know, like nobody anymore could put up with that sort of like, well, admitting you have a problem is the first step, you know. Like, okay, well, you have to do all the others, and you have like, whereas before it always felt that people, I don't know, this is bullshit, but like it always felt that people just stopped at admitting the problem, but now trying to integrate it slightly.
Yes, there was no step two, was there?
Yeah.
It just became like saying like, well, the thing is that I had no intimacy from my mother, and that's why I am this way, and you have to deal with it.
You have to deal with it, exactly. And it's like, no, that's not acceptable anymore, thank you.
Yeah.
Figure it out,
work it out. My friend Tash calls that a man who has a doctor reason he can't be nice.
Got my doctor's note. Yeah. Yep.
We've really gone all over the place with old Annie. Oh God, what else do we want? So the thing is, it's like I've struggled to come up with like a lesson plan for this episode, because this is someone with a vast body of work. You know, this is like dozens of books.
Yeah.
And so many shades of her personality and her oeuvre. You know.
Completely. And I don't like all of them.
Yeah, which ones don't you like? She's dead now, so we can say so.
To speak ill of the dead. I'm just looking at your dog. You look at that face.
I know, we brought the dog to the studio. I know, we've locked her outside the soundproof. So she's just
Why you leave me?
Why you leave me, mother?
Oh. What ones don't I like? I don't like the ones that get a little bit too plot-driven.
Oh, you like the sort of like the tangents of just like, soft, rich materials and thinking about death.
Yeah.
Is that really your shit?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's it. I don't know. I can't think of the ones that I don't like. I love you, Anne.
I love you, Anne. Because even the Sleeping Beauty things, it's like,
oh my gosh,
might not like it, but I fucking respect it. And I respect that she did it.
It blew my tiny mind. It blew my tiny mind. I particularly love that I had taken them out of the library. I ordered them off the library system and went to collect them, and then read them and went, oh.
Right. What I love about that is that if you're ever a suspect in a murder case,
yeah,
and there's a really good lawyer,
yeah,
they're going to use that. It's the public record.
Public record. Siobhan is take. No, I mean, when was that? We have to burn the library.
How closely is Cork City Libraries keeping their their files? Oh God, I think the legacy of her is so long. I don't think there could be a True Blood without Anne Rice, right? That idea of like the Southern Gothic sort of vampire, I think that's so dependent on her. And I just hope that as we move away, as her work, I don't think it is very fashionable right now. I think that very florid way of writing does kind of seem old fashioned. And you do, when I was picking up these books, I had to sort of adjust to it, right? Mm-hmm, it's like adjusting to a certain cadence. But I really hope that people revisit her and realize how much she's actually responsible for, because I do think that now it is quite normal and it's like basically expected for us to be like, here's a film but from the point of view of the bad guy, mm-hmm, like, you know, mm-hmm, either whether it's like Patrick Bateman or like the Joker, it's like, or it's like these stories that you know but from the bad person kind of thing. But she kind of invented that sort of wasn't a thing.
Yeah she did. And
of the sympathetic psychopath, really.
Yeah. And of, I don't think she invented shameless pleasure.
No.
But she relished in it.
Yeah.
She relished in it, and she allowed little doorways in for people who were like, who wouldn't have felt perhaps that they could enjoy being the bad guy without it being a bad thing, and relishing in their badness. It's fun.
It's kind of fabulous, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
One thing I did want to talk about, which I think it's fascinating, because like she was a very forward-thinking person, very, you know, leftist values, but she fucking hated fan fiction.
Yeah.
And was very litigious about it.
Which I
find
loved
quite
it.
Funny.
Loved when she got cross. She also had like quite an interesting, a bit like Neil Gaiman and a lot of like, and even Amanda Palmer stuff, a very sort of robust and real relationship with her fans.
Yes, she had a Facebook page that she sort of responded to people very frequently.
Like, yeah,
it was quite easy to get a response from her, which
completely
is very,
and she felt that as much part of her legacy and her job as doing her scuttling away to her covert library, gothic library, and writing away in her quill, you know. Like,
one of my favorite things that she said was she talked about how well Queen of the Damned did, and she said like, oh yeah, a regular person could live off Queen of the Damned alone. I'm not a regular person anymore. It's all gotten too crazy.
Yeah.
And she sort of like waved her hand as if she's referring to the upkeep of several properties.
I mean, and she was like, and did you see her rings? Like, I mean, there's something, luxurious about her. Like, I'm not a materialist. I don't covet lots of money in any way, but I love her, and I'd never got the impression who the fuck, who cares? But like, she liked nice things, and not nice because she saw them on Instagram, but nice because, do you know, by Liz Taylor or something, do you know?
Yeah, or Jackie Collins.
Yeah.
Just like, here's my stuff.
Like, like, oh yes. And if one cushion feels nice, we'll have 20 because that'll be 20 times nicer. Like, opulence.
I love that woman.
Opulence.
I can't ever be that woman. I don't really have the aesthetic sense, but when I meet them, I want to draw them very close.
But they're naturally born.
Yeah, they are.
They are naturally born. I have one particularly in my life, and she was born like that. And I think I was my sort of aesthetic shall ever be sort of slightly studenty, Dostoevsky, and I think. looking, you know, still taking the soaps from the hotel rooms.
It should never change. You shouldn't change people, you know, it's fine.
People are who they are, okay?
I remember like someone saying they worked at Abbey Road and they came across Paul McCartney because he was doing a benefit there, and that the story was that Paul McCartney didn't tip them. And I was like, first of all, why are you expecting Paul McCartney to carry cash?
Yeah.
And second of all, it's like, I imagine being that rich and famous that everyone expects you to make a grand display of wealth everywhere you go.
Yes, no, that's an awful story. I hate that.
I know. The other person comes off much badly, I think.
Yeah, like, also, this is Abbey Road.
This is basically his house.
Like, no, it's England. Why are you tipping? Tipping for what?
Oh, it's like, you know, it's like the centre, the performing arts centre that's near there. It wasn't like the zebra crossing.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, but yeah. I
didn't tip the guy at the zebra.
When I lived in Kilburn when I was in drama school, and the house was always open to people coming over, and the amount of times we'd go to the pub, and then at the end of the pub, I was like, let's go to the zebra crossing in Abbey Road. And there are cop cars that go up and down there all night. But it got to a point and they're like, Siobhan. I was like, oh, yeah. Yeah, this is Niall. He's over from Cork.
Wants to see the road.
Wants to see the road. Will you take this picture, actually? Yeah. I got over there so much. Yeah, no, I don't like that story.
No, me neither. Yeah. I can't remember why I told it, but now we should wrap up.
Oh, yeah, the opulence of it all.
The opulence, yes.
Fan fiction. She didn't like fan fiction.
But what the thing is, like, people still don't like her because of her anti. She was very litigious. She went after people, which I think is funny.
Yeah.
But it was her thing of, like, it's like early internet where. Like, the idea that somebody would be writing your copyrighted characters into their own stuff and possibly getting paid for it by other fans would have been like, I would have been, because now there's a rich context for the existence of fan fiction, but then there wasn't.
There's also a history of it too, you know? Yeah. Like, yeah, you're tapping into the grand tradition. This would have all been new. It's like, no!
No, don't make money off my stuff.
Exactly.
Also, characters I'm still writing because she left like 15 years between those vampire books, you know. So
I'm
on Anne's side.
Go Anne.
I love an overdog. Love Paul McCartney. Love Anne Rhymes.
Love an overdog. I'm trying to remember when you were saying that. There's some story. Somebody told me. Is it Joan Collins? God, Joan, don't be at me. But somebody who will take them. It's Joan Collins. Somebody told me she'll take, like, if there's, you know, at a do or whatever, she'll put the sandwiches in her bag.
Oh,
and
I love that.
And if she likes a lamp in the hotel, that goes into the bag as well. And I'm like,
I love that. It does not make me feel remotely judgmental.
No. I mean, I love it too. That's why, like, I really love that. But I hope that. I know that when you say it, it's not meant to be a positive story, but I'm like, yeah, you're brilliant. Fair play. I'll take it. What? It's
we also have
dragging a standard lamp behind her. She goes,
by the cord. That's mine.
But it's also and the that hat thing off of, the concierge.
When
and that's
women
mine.
Do that, though, of it's something like, you ain't going to say shit. Yeah. I'm Joan Collins.
Yeah. Yeah,
when
yeah.
Women just like take up not just, you know, oh, that thing of like women taking up space, but like too much space.
Yeah.
Obnoxious amounts of space.
Oh my
God. Taking the space with them as they leave.
Dragging the curtains down. Yeah. Fair play.
All right, we should wrap up. Siobhan McSweeney, you're the most famous Cork woman in the world. I'm the most second famous.
we'll have to update the list. Sorry, Fiona.
Sorry, Fiona, but you haven't done shit in a while. Yeah. It's Fiona Shaw, everyone. She hasn't done shit. I think you're number one now.
Oh my God. God, I'm sorry.
So you've done so many things that people can watch and there'll be more.
Yeah.
I'm trying to give you an elegant wrap up. You've done pottery.
Pottery, yeah. When will this come out?
Probably a couple of weeks.
Yeah, so next thing is pottery mix next yeah
That's
so
the Great British Pottery
it's not the Great down. British Pottery the Throwdown pottery. The Great Pottery Throwdown, okay. Which I say to all my Republican family, it is the Great Pottery Throwdown because pottery is great
and
transcends all borders.
No, I love that show so much. I'm sure I'm sure people just like cry at you in the street about just how comforting it is.
It's so lovely. People have such a lovely response to it.
And I imagine when people have the worst things happen to them in their life, the first thing they do is make a cup of tea, and the second thing they do is watch pottery throw down.
And everybody wants to know if it's as nice as it seems. And I'm like, Yeah. It is. It's really nice. I mean, how could it not? It's watching people make pots.
Is that guy still on it who cries?
Yeah.
I love him.
Yeah. And Rich is, and they're big old nerds. They're like having chats about the clay and you're like, I don't give a shit. Like, this is fantastic.
I love your role as like the mischievous imp of the pottery studio. Like, what you doing? Okay, bye.
Because they're really into it. I just think it's I think passionate people are inherently funny. It's great room for comedy, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. People who are extremely focused on the thing they care about most in the world while you know nothing and do nothing. It's so impish. It's very Puck. And there's Holding, of course.
There's Holding. Holding is, I think it's been shown in Australia at the moment. It's still on ITV Hub. I don't know if it's been out on Irish television yet. Obviously, the last season of Derry Girls is on 4OD or All Four. I'm trying to think anything that's coming out soon. Nothing's coming out soon. The next thing. Yeah, it's going to be a nice summer, I think.
Yeah. I'm so pleased for you.
I'm so pleased for you.
The dog wants to go out. Let's let her out. Okay, bye everyone.
Bye.
This has been Sentimental Garbage and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. The podcast was produced and edited by me, with mix and music by Harry Harris and artwork by Gavin Day. If you'd like to email me about the pod, you can do so on sentimentalpod@gmail.com or get in touch with me directly on Twitter or Instagram at Zaraline.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.